Welcome to the ESG Matters podcast. My name is Amat Gomes, and I'm your host. Today, we have Dr. Ashish Sharma, founding director and CEO of Sustainability Alternatives, an environmental sustainability consulting firm registered in the UK. Dr. Sharma holds a PhD in civil and environmental engineering. His PhD thesis was entitled Quantification and Mitigation of Particulate Matter Exposure to Young Children. Thank you for joining us today, Dr. Sharma.
Hi, thanks Amat for having me on board. And it's such a pleasure to discuss on this topic of sustainability with you.
Thank you so much. And just to start things off, how did you become involved in sustainability?
Sure. So actually, my engagement with sustainability started way back around 2016 when I was doing my MRes, Master of Research at Macquarie University in Sydney, Australia. Now, this was my second master's, and my master's thesis was actually titled as Life Cycle Sustainability Impact Assessment of Alternative Transport Fuels in the Australian Transport Sector. Now, I was actually at a broader level engaged into environmental engineering during my bachelor's. You know, I mean, second year of my bachelor, I attended an international conference in 2010 when I was in my undergrad college, Aligarh Muslim University. It's a popular central government institution in India. Now, they were organizing this conference in collaboration with the University of Toledo in Ohio State. And I presented a paper which was titled as, you know, Sustainable Sources of Energies, Promising Alternatives to Conventional Sources of Energies. Now, when I presented this sort of talk, then I got very interesting questions. And, you know, I mean, during that time, you know, Professor Ashok Kumar, who was chair in Department of Civil Engineering at Toledo, he was very encouraging. And after that, you know, I mean, it's sort of laid down the foundation, and I happened to get, you know, sort of A grades into environmental engineering subjects. And this really sparked my interest. And then the breakthrough really happened during my MRes at Macquarie when I was doing my MRes. But then on the top of it, I always believed into, you know, sort of making sustainability as the mission, because I've been sort of born and raised in India. I've seen and witnessed environmental and air pollution crisis when I was growing up. So I always felt really bad when seeing this sort of black carbon and soot emissions when I was personally sort of exposed, and I observed sort of the lifestyle, and it was really, you know, very toxic to see, you know, that sort of when we were born and raised into such a air pollution crisis and all.
And I think it's really important, and I think it's interesting to point out that you were able to take your both personal experience growing up someplace where you saw the impact of sustainability or the lack thereof, and really start to craft opportunities for yourself in the academic world and write papers that could help to mitigate and address it. But I want to get back to the air quality topic that you mentioned. You know, air quality, or sometimes the lack thereof, has an outsourced impact on marginalized groups. Can you explain why that is for people who may not understand that linkage?
Sure. Yeah, I think it's a very important topic which you have just touched upon. There are indeed, you know, racial and ethnic minorities, the lower income groups, which are sort of worst affected by this environmental disparities, or you may call it environmental injustice, and or you may also call it, you know, sort of climate sort of injustice. So these sort of people who are coming from the developing sort of countries, they are having sort of double sort of challenges. You know, first sort of challenges arise from their sort of poor socioeconomic backgrounds and poor sort of, you know, standard of living. And then on the top of it, this is worsened by, you know, the environmental disparities which does exist. And in fact, actually, you know, according to the World Health Organization estimates, you will be surprised that ambient outdoor air pollution in both cities and rural areas is, in fact, estimated to cause some 4.2 million premature deaths worldwide. And these are with reference to 2016, and these are WHO estimates. Now, out of all these premature deaths, almost 91% of these occur in low and middle income countries. And further to elaborate, these sort of, this toll is actually highest to the people who are from Southeast Asia and Western Pacific regions. Now, apart from this, you may have, you know, watched some documentaries, or you may have seen the lifestyle in the developing countries, that indoor smoke from household air pollution is another actually challenge in such countries, where almost 2.6 billion people worldwide are actually, you know, using biomass and coal for cooking and for heating their homes during the winters. Now, again, you know, I mean, another estimate is that, you know, 3.8 million premature deaths are attributable to household air pollution in 2016. And most of these are again occurring into the low and middle income countries. And then, you know, I mean, this is such a serious issue, very important to really enlighten the citizens, particularly through outreach activities where we engage different stakeholders, citizens, school children and the parents actually, and also the school districts and management authorities. They may be doing really well in terms of the economic development in these countries, but then, you know, when it comes to the health impact, then I think somewhere there are gaps actually which needs to be filled. And according to the GBD estimate, Global Burden of Disease Study, you will be surprised that outdoor air pollution is related to more deaths than unsafe sex leading to HIV and AIDS, or even unsafe water or malaria. And in fact, annual air pollution is related to diseases also have much higher death toll than even the COVID-19 crisis. Now, everyone was, you know, alarmed when, you know, COVID-19 happened, and then everyone, there was a lot of, you know, information overload also. Now, I'm not denying the fact that it was a global sort of emergency and pandemic, which then converted to the endemic. But what I want to say is that, you know, air pollution is much bigger sort of crisis, which needs immediate attention. Now, apart from the challenges and the disparities in developing versus developed countries in terms of the disproportionate toll on the health of these citizens from developing countries, what I want to also say is that there is other level of disparity which exists in terms of different population cohort. Now, this is in terms of disparities in exposure of young children and senior citizens being exposed much higher than the other sort of adults who are healthy and, you know, fit. Now, my whole PhD thesis is actually titled based on mitigating air pollution exposure of young children. So we are almost 4.5 years I've devoted to the topic of young children air pollution exposure assessment and mitigation. So now this is a very important topic, particularly about young children air pollution exposure. And again, these children from poorer socioeconomic backgrounds in the developing countries are much more exposed. Now, why these young children are particularly exposed? Because of a variety of reasons. Now, this could be because they inhale a higher dose of airborne particles related to their lung size and body weight in comparison to the adults. And in general, we may say that the respiratory rate of children per body unit weight is almost double compared to the adults. And then, you know, I mean, they have developing systems, immature tissues, immune system, and then they have developing brains, and they have permeable cell membrane lining inside the respiratory tract. Now, all these reasons create a sort of, you know, very serious sort of vulnerability for these young children who are exposed to, you know, traffic-related air pollutants, particularly, you know, PM2.5 and ultrafine particles are to be blamed for all this crisis and premature sort of mortality. So we need to pay right attention, you know, at the right sort of pollutants. And it's very important to ask right questions. So we need to really focus on the ultrafine particles because they are very, very fine. They settle deep down in your lungs. And then, you know, they lead to all these different sort of health impacts. So, yes.
And those are some startling figures that you talked about when you said that, one, this is really disproportionately impacting folks in developing economies. This is really impacting sort of both people on the extremes, the very young and the very old. And then people oftentimes who are marginalized in society, whether they are low income or people or persons of color. So I think those are really important things that people who are listening to this should really think about and understand. And then for people who work in companies and work in governments for different countries, what can those companies and countries do to improve the air quality and by extension, decrease the negative externalities associated with poor air quality that you expressed before?
Sure. Yeah, I think it's a very important point which you have raised, that all these partnerships and collaborations at multiple levels are very, very important, where we don't work in silos. And air pollution is such a complex issue that, you know, there is not a single magic bullet which can really solve this crisis. And so what we need is basically a multi-pronged and multi-layered approach where we engage several stakeholders. And Of course, you know, in whatever decisions we are framing and whatever policy briefs we are designing, the citizens are supposed to be at the center of all this decision-making process. Now, traditionally, you know, particularly in the developing countries, what happened is that, you know, the policies are decided, you know, in these big sort of, with the big elites and all these people at the power. And then, you know, these citizens and those who are actually the victims of all this exposure are somewhere, you know, left behind in this sort of, you know, process. So during my 5 years at University of Surrey and Guildford at United Kingdom, what I actually learned was while working in our very diverse research lab, which is, you know, Global Center of Clean Air Research under the premises of Department of Civil and Environmental Engineering. We, in fact, led by my primary supervisor, Professor Prashant Kumar, we were engaged into a lot of community outreach activities. I mean, where many times we were conducting, let's say, you know, Clean Air Day in the city, where we are inviting people from all different age groups, including children, young children, and senior citizens, and policymakers and academics who are actually engaged into this process. So what we were really trying to do is to transform all this complex knowledge of research articles into very simplified tools. And then also we also published some sort of tools where you can select, you know, green infrastructure species. For instance, you know, you can measure the distance of your house from the highway. And then based on this and then, you know, other sort of specifications, you can design and tailor the vegetation for your front lawns for your houses. So these are some of the small sort of nature-based solutions which can really help in making a positive transition. And I mean, in the developed countries and particularly in the Europe, you see in Italy and Belgium, Denmark, and all these Scandinavian countries, that they are really taking the lead in terms of policymakers are and the town planners and these mayors of cities are almost on the same page, at least. They are much more on the same page compared to the policymakers and citizens in the developing countries. Now, it's very important to also understand that the whatever technologies and tools and knowledge base which we are developing, we cannot simply cut, copy and paste the solutions from for advanced countries to the developing countries context. We really need to transform these into and contextualize these according to the local conditions, let's say prevalent in India, Africa, or any other, you know, sort of South American country. Because it's very important to really understand the root cause of the problem. For instance, I may sort of delve deeper with another very personal example, the sort of research which I did during my first MS at the Gwangju Institute of Science and Technology in South Korea. So I looked at the climatic and economic impacts of black carbon emission reduction in Indian transport sector. Now, I did, you know, almost hundreds of research papers I read and we identified the gaps. What we noticed was that in the developing countries, I mean, the sulfur content was much higher in the fuel, let's say diesel or petrol. And then on the top of it, the vehicle technology was not cleaner. So it was almost like the dirty vehicles combined with dirty fuel and lax emission standards, which was creating a lot of chaos and, you know, all this emission, particularly from the transport sector in India. And similar story, you know, sort of applies for any other developing country. So in a nutshell, what we need is that the governments, local governments, scientists, citizens, and all these sit together, and then they draft policies aligned with what is actually needed to solve this crisis. First, we need really stringent emission standards. And then these standard emission standards really need to be implemented at local level. It's not that pick up 4 or 5 odd mega cities and then you say the problem is solved. It's not yet solved, because you may know that, you know, implementation is really poor when it comes from center to the state level in these developing countries context. So really, you know, I mean, what we need is that we need collaborations, we need partnerships. We also need private sector to really chip in and collaborate with the public sector and local citizens to come up with very innovative solutions, just like mobile air pollution sensing labs or low cost air pollution sensing, and also open air cloud based sort of air pollution databases where we can engage and have on board everyone, which can then, you know, chip into the end user perspective, such as, you know, there can be apps where citizens can interact in real time and this app can suggest them clean air routes and all. So I think these are some of top level summary only, but we can go through on and on and have a sort of multiple sort of strategies. So let me quote a few more sort of bullet points. Now, the developing countries, particularly at the government levels, they need to have all these policies. They need to invest in renewable energy sources, and they really need to transform the uptake of this public transportation and really create a momentum of behavioral and citizen science activities for enhancing what the cycling and walking sort of lifestyles. And then organizations can also try to integrate sustainability into the core of their business model. Now, why I really want to emphasize on this, integrating sustainability at the core of the business models, because that's what we are trying to do through ESG, sort of structured ESG reforms at sustainability alternatives at our firm. And then organizations may also try to opt for less toxic, more environmentally friendly sort of materials and alternatives. And they may scheme, they may sort of, you know, encourage schemes such as work from home, which we saw and observed during the COVID lockdown. And this is really, you know, to engage with the environmental groups and as well. And then from the community's perspective, you know, local citizens should really make it their sort of karma and dharma that, you know, they have to really conserve energy. They should look for Energy Star labels and also prefer active mode of transport wherever possible and reduce motorized transport. And there has to be really a public sort of momentum to raise this ball game of shifting towards active mode of transport and reduce sort of vehicle idling and all these sort of small changes, but then they have sort of huge potential to make a positive impact to transition to a more sustainable and green sort of economy.
I think a good way to sort of summarize that is making sure that, one, looking at the process in which developed countries, that, like you mentioned, Italy and a few others, the process that they've used to come up with innovative solutions. But then for those countries, those developing economies, to make sure that they're bringing the right voices and all voices to the table to come up with a solution that speaks and addresses their local needs, and then also create an environment in which regulations incentivize collaboration, as well as the fact that those regulations can also be used to improve the uptick in behavioral changes that people can make, citizens can make, to both improve, decrease their carbon footprint and increase the uptake in renewable energy sources, and then leverage companies to provide the right technology that can both monitor, track, and mitigate as much as possible the negative impacts of the air quality. So I think when you talk about the developing economies, one thing that always sticks in my head is that oftentimes we hear that developing economies of the world must improve their air quality, which is very much true, while the developed economies did not have to worry about air quality when they were going through things like industrialization. In your opinion, is there a way for developing economies to industrialize for their growing population? We know that the vast majority of the human expansion the next 100 years is really going to happen in places like Sub-Saharan Africa, India, Southeast Asia. How can they sort of grow their population and improve their air quality while they're growing their economy at the same time?
Sure, Amath. This is really a very pressing issue and a very important topic which we need to discuss here. Firstly, I would like to say that by any means, this is just a sort of disclaimer, that by any means, we are not denying the fact that everyone has to mitigate the carbon emissions, and that all of us have this shared responsibility to really embark towards a sustainable, low carbon, or maybe let's say a net zero economy. Now, having said that, this is a win-win strategy for all, be it whether you are from a developed or developing country, hardly matters, because air pollution is really a global issue and everyone is confronted with these issues. So this is important to really know that it is solving this crisis is in the best interest of everyone, be it from developing or developed country. Now, it's also very important, having said that, that there are three important points which I want to make. Now, whatever discussions we are having about this sort of this specific question, they may come under the umbrella of climate justice and equity, or maybe you can call it environmental sort of justice. So historically, the largest share and even the current global GHG emissions have occurred from the advanced countries, from the developed country. And then the developing countries, people from the developing countries are having much, much lower per capita emissions. And then my third point is that the share of global emissions from the developing countries will continue to rise. Now, in order to meet their own socioeconomic and developmental needs, because we really don't want to leave anyone behind into this sort of our goal of sustainable development, goal of bringing everyone to have good life, good sort of access to resources, where everyone is sort of prosper, leading to sort of living a very prosperous and healthy life. Now, most of our climate change and air quality, these sort of discussions, people generally tend to, you know, sort of oversimplify, and they tend to, you know, overlook some of the intricacies which surround all this sort of crisis and developing versus developed country context. This is very important what we are trying to touch upon. Now, in most of our discussions, you know, people end up saying that, you know, I mean, China, US and India are the world's top three emitters, and they in fact account for almost 50% of global CO2 emissions. And in fact, world's top 20 emitters account for 80% of total GHG emissions. Now, we may say this, and it may be partially true, but then we are not having a very well-rounded and very well-informed sort of discussion. It's not a very well-rounded perspective. And as researchers and scientists and someone who is really, you know, expert on the subject, we really need to sort of take a deep dive into this. Now, what I also want to bring along on the table is that, you know, we really need to bring along this per capita perspective. Now, you know, I mean, there's a very sort of simplified example that an average person in the US emits more than twice as much as someone living in the China. And an average person living in the US emits almost five times more than someone living in Mexico, or almost eight times to someone living in India. This is the sort of disparity which needs to be visualized and need to be sort of really felt. And then only we do have some sort of emotional question to tackle with this issue, when we have more sort of empathy to people from the developing countries and their circumstances and their aspirations, that they also want to meet their, you know, standard of living in a sort of aspirations. Now, as the countries are developing, be it China or any other country which is advancing, you may see that per capita emissions are bound to increase. Now, as you know that in the, as we may know that, you know, in the developed countries, they have highest per capita emissions, and these are much above the global average. Now, the onus basically should be more on the developed countries to really fast track the pace of mitigating per capita reductions, per capita emissions basically. And then there is sort of moral sort of and moral responsibility of the advanced countries to really help with the technology transfer and also the financial support and for very sort of a smooth transition towards a sustainable and low carbon economy, to help these, you know, sort of developing countries. So we may not always blame sort of developing countries that, I mean, you have to really cut down your emissions. And then on the top of it, we also know that all these dirty sort of manufacturing companies are being relocated and shifted to the Asia and Southeast Asia or any other, you know, developing country or South America or South Africa. Now, this is more like a paradox, and this is more like counterintuitive, and it may not help in the long run unless we really try to understand this situation. Now, I may put here some other examples, you know, very interesting facts that, you know, I mean, today, most developing countries which have reduced their poverty rates have also increased their carbon emissions, as I said before. Now, if you take an example of, let's say, East Asia and the Pacific, now they elevated the poverty decline from 1.1 billion to 161 million between 1980s to 2011. This is almost an 85% decrease. Now, at the same time, you may see that carbon dioxide emissions have increased from 2 tons per capita to 5.9 tons per capita. This is almost an 185% increase. And similarly, in the Southeast Asia, you may observe similar numbers, where people living in extreme poverty decreased by 30%, and at the same time, GHG emissions increased by almost 200%. Now, I may rest this argument with this quote from the World Bank Transport Economics and Sector Policy Briefing, that global warming is primarily a result of the industrialization and motorization levels in the OECD countries, on whom the main sort of responsibility for mitigation should lie. Now, again, I mean, I want to, you know, reiterate the disclaimer that it is in really in the best interest of everyone, be it from developed or developing country, that we have to really leapfrog to more sustainable, cleaner and greener energies to really help mitigate both personal, corporate and national level sort of carbon footprint. And in fact, they talk about handprint these days, you know, organizations, what they can do, they can help to reduce not only their emissions, not only across their supply chains, but they may also contribute to reducing the emissions from other small and medium scale enterprises. So, you know, I mean, developing countries may really benefit by this emission reductions if they can get some support from the developed countries. And, you know, I mean, one very good thing which developing country can do is to really leapfrog, but they do need support in this such a transition. I guess that's it. Yeah.
Yeah, thank you for that. And when you talk about leapfrogging technology specifically in the developing economies and the need to do that, a quick question I have is, do you see any technologies or partnerships that could serve as a model for improving air quality? Because to your point, this serves in our own best interest, regardless of where you live in the world. And if a lot of this is really a lot of the negative impacts of to our air quality has come from the industrialization from OECD countries, then that's something that I'm just curious if you've seen technologies or partnerships that have that you could say holds up as a model for improving air quality.
Sure. Again, I think it's a very relevant sort of question. And indeed, I think the partnerships and collaborations are happening at much wider scale than previously we may have imagined, let's say, 20 or 30 years down the line. So they are happening and, they are really benefiting. Now, all these collaborations may help in multiple aspects. Now, one of the aspects is really the community outreach and the raising awareness of common people, actually. Now, some of the common people may not take one or two odd scientists or one or two odd groups very seriously, but citizens will definitely take someone, a cohort or a sort of ecosystem very seriously when this ecosystem comprises of very diverse academic research communities and which represent globally, not only developed countries, but also people, research groups from developing countries. And similarly, the technology, they want to see that there are, technology companies on board, which can really transform this knowledge into very helpful tools and technologies. And then, in the developing countries also, and also in the developed countries, we see that a lot of smart city missions and this sort of lot of talks, we see that the government is laying these policies and putting together all these policies of smart city planning and all. So we do need multiple partnerships and collaborations where we do have different actors, academic actors, and technology actors, and community outreach could be another sort of level where, and in the community outreach, not only citizens, but all governments and local governments need to play their role. Now, having said that, there are also specific sort of key actions which private sector can also take a lead. For instance, few examples I may quote, let's say from my recent affiliation from University of Surrey. There are a lot of examples of mobile air pollution monitoring. And then, the other examples include, let's say, open air labs where, open air quality innovation labs. And you see also these mobile air pollution monitoring, which are actually, happening and where citizens are really contributing. And they are also benefiting in terms of getting, access to cleaner routes. So there are a lot of apps which many actually startups. We also get a lot of requests for collaborations for Sustainability Alternatives UK from some of these very young and agile and very dynamic sort of startups, which are really sort of transitioning this whole landscape by coming up with very innovative and technology solutions, which are deep rooted into artificial intelligence and neural networks, and which are really making good use of big data analytics or predictive data analytics. And who would have really imagined that, we would have technologies where vehicle can sort of interact with the infrastructure. So, vehicle-to-vehicle interaction and vehicle-to-infrastructure interaction has become really a very, very sort of commonplace sort of thing. And you see, autonomous vehicles and driverless cars and all this is happening already in California and some of the cities in Europe as well. So all this is happening only because of partnership. People cannot actually work in silos and then solve such serious crisis. And then in terms of industries, I may say that air quality issues should be really integrated into the CSR or corporate social responsibility activities of these companies. And then all these companies need to really quantify air pollution across their supply chains and manufacturing processes. And then they also need to take a deep dive in terms of compiling emission inventories, where citizens are also aware about what is really the footprint of this sort of product and what could be the sustainable alternatives to such products. And then, we discussed already these awareness and all these things already. And then all these industries should have this obligation that they really need to be transparent in terms of disclosures and reporting. And they should also have a very clear roadmap and strategies for emission reduction and all. Now, one last I may summarize, end up with this sort of case study of IKEA. This is a very compelling sort of case study where you see private partners sort of chipping in to really solve this very serious issue. So, I mean, in North India, basically, during the winters, the air pollution crisis becomes really, really severe. I mean, the visibility reduces to almost zero, and there are hundreds of deaths and thousands of deaths which occur due to poor visibility, particularly during the December or January during the winters. Now, adjacent to the Delhi, there are other states such as Punjab and other states where farmers are actually not able to afford very costly machinery which can transform their stubble or rice crops leftovers. And, you know, I mean, because these farmers can't afford, what they can actually afford is to really to burn these crop residue. Now, these crop residue burning leads to serious particulate matter emissions, and all these emissions are then transferred from Punjab to other states such as Delhi, and then it becomes a very complex issue. Now, there have been a lot of conflicts between, you know, different states, let's say Delhi and Punjab, where, you know, Punjab says that it's not because of us, and Delhi says the pollution is not from Delhi, but it's coming from other states. And we know that pollution knows no boundary. So IKEA has really come up with this solution that they have repurposed rice straw residues into a very innovative raw material, which then they use towards designing and very innovative products for their own sort of product range. So this is one of the very important example where the rice straws have become a renewable material source for the IKEA. And then IKEA has also prioritized, you know, sustainability in its business strategy by targeting almost 100% renewables for its operations and supply chains. And then they want to achieve zero emissions from their home deliveries by 2025. Now, this is one of the very important examples. It's not only one example which stands alone, but these are some of the examples which really have potential to transform this partnerships of private and public to a very next level.
Well, thank you for that. And ending on that great case study by IKEA. So if someone wants to get a hold of you, what's the best way, Dr. Sharma, that they can find you and find your company? So that way, if they want to engage the services of sustainability alternatives, they can do that.
So thanks once again, Amad, for having me on board for this podcast. And I think at our startup, which is Sustainability Alternatives, we are really very keen to engage at multiple levels, at institutional levels, including all these think tanks, experts, academic organizations, and SMEs. So we are getting very good sort of response. And I'm very active at LinkedIn as well, you know. So one of the means to get in touch and to get hold of us is through LinkedIn messages. And also then, you know, we have a website, which is www.sustainabilityalternatives.com. And also, we can be reached by emails. Our email is admin@sustainabilityalternatives.com. And also ashish@sustainabilityalternatives.com. My name is A-S-H-I-S-H. This is how you spell ashish@sustainabilityalternatives.com. So we really encourage all these sustainability professionals or climate change or climate change enthusiasts to really collaborate with us. And we are really, really happy any sort of positive impact through us and really happy to collaborate with different partners.
Well, thank you, Dr. Sharma, for being a guest on the ESG Matters podcast, and I thank you for your time.
Thank you. Thank you, Amad. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to the ESG Matters podcast. Please like, share, and subscribe to the ESG Matters podcast on your choice of podcast platforms. This podcast is brought to you by Amad Gumis and theme music by Dexter Thomas.